Well, peace, friends. My name's Tom. I'm the pastor here at Sycamore Creek, and today's a special day because we're wrapping up this series on the birds and the bees. We've been here for 5 weeks looking at sex and relationships. It also happens to be the last worship service that I'm going to be in with Sycamore Creek for 3.5 months as my sabbatical begins tomorrow. We'll be attending another church through the summer when we're not traveling and visiting churches through the summer. But I have the opportunity to interview Rebecca to wrap this up today, Rebecca Fitton. Rebecca is a licensed professional counselor, and she has a specialization in sex therapy as well. And Rebecca, you first came to Sycamore Creek through this campus here at South Lansing.
Yep.
But you guys are over at the Potterville campus now, you and your husband and family. Tell us how you ended up here at our church and what your husband's up to and your family at the other campus.
Yeah. So about 2 years ago, we moved back to Michigan. Both Kevin, my husband, and I, we grew up in Michigan, but we were on the East Coast for about 16 years. And about 11 years in Vermont, we planted a church in Vermont, but really felt like it was time to move closer back to family. We, about 2 years ago, moved back, and somebody from our church in Vermont knew Sarah, and
my wife, Sarah.
Yes, I don't think they actually have ever met. I think they actually just know each other through some writing connections, and so she said, hey, I think you should check out this church. It kind of sounds a lot like our church. And so we did, about 2 years ago, came to this campus and really enjoyed it and felt like it just really resonated with us. And so we started attending this campus, and then my husband, who is musical and was asked to be on staff to do the music at the Potterville campus. So we're currently attending there more often than we are here.
So you came to Sycamore Creek and thought, this is a good pool of people who need therapy.
No.
And you guys became partners here at Sycamore Creek about 2 years ago, I think it was.
Yeah. Pretty early on, yeah.
Now, I know your background a little bit. You're Dutch. You grew up Reformed. Mm-hmm. Your husband is a Baptist preacher. How does a Dutch Reformed Baptist preacher's wife end up as a sex therapist?
That's a really good question. Yes, all those descriptors in one sentence don't usually go together. I did my master's in counseling at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and as a part of one of my courses, one of my marriage and family classes, we did just a brief kind of overview of sex therapy, and one of my professors just really urged our class to really consider developing more specialization in the area of sex therapy. So that kind of planted a seed in my mind, but still, with my background, I thought, oh, that's just, like, that's so weird. What would I tell my parents?
Do your parents know?
You should ask them.
They do now.
That was a kind of a seed that was planted in my head about the idea of maybe doing that. And then my husband and I were a part of some Bible studies early on in our marriage, and we ended up talking to some of the other couples about, I had a couple of friends in there that we talked about sex, we talked openly about it, and they had some different difficulties, and it just sort of reminded me back to that conversation that my professor had, and because they were saying, I don't know who to talk to about this. This is so personal, and I just don't feel comfortable going to anybody. And it just was sort of another kind of urge, kind of put in my mind, kind of a push from God to say, you know what, you should learn more about this. You should be a person who your friends, like them, could talk to about sex, specifically who are Christians as well.
It sounds like your calling to become a sex therapist happened in a Bible study.
It did, yeah.
You never
at
know
seminary,
what's going to happen.
At seminary.
In a Bible study, friends.
Yeah.
So what is a sex therapist? Do you, like, go watch people have sex and tell them how to do it better?
No. Actually, I have had that question, though. Somebody did, like, legit, and I was like, no, we have boundaries. But a sex therapist is somebody who has taken some additional coursework that helps understand the physiology of sex. So there's a lot of kind of medical understanding, as well as the emotional and psychological aspects of sex. So it's really integrating a couple of fields together in order to be able to help couples, you know, deal with some of the difficulties that they may be experiencing.
It's just like any other counseling. They come sit with you in your office.
Yeah. Or
you do video counseling too, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do online counseling, yep, with some of my clients that still live in Vermont. So, yeah.
So you got a degree from a Christian seminary, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. Mm-hmm. You're a Christian. What difference does it make that I'm talking to a Christian who's a sex therapist than just talking to a sex therapist?
Yeah, What we have done, what my program and what I've done, is really think through what does the Bible say about sex, which actually requires a lot of thought since the Bible is not a sex manual. You may have noticed there's not a lot in there, but understanding, like, what is God's heart for sex? What is God's design for sex? And really understanding what are the boundaries around sex in relationship. And so it's really an integration of theology and the practical application of helping people with sex. So that's what makes...
So tell us, what does the Bible say about why does God care about sex?
Well, God cares about sex because God made it. He designed sex in a particular fashion. And what he created, you know, we see in Genesis that God looks at it and God sees that it's good. And so... out of that goodness, he really cares about what he's created. And I think God cares about it because he created it specifically with intention. You know, we could have babies in lots of different potential ways, you know, like we talk about the stork, like that could have been a real thing. Like babies could have really, God could have really made it happen that way.
Or women could have laid eggs.
Right, exactly. We could be kind of, you know, we couldn't go to church because we'd be, you know, sitting on a nest or something.
Yeah.
But so he didn't create it that way. And God doesn't waste opportunities to really teach us about what his heart is and what he desires. And so I think that what I see in scripture is that God really desires sex to be something that really teaches us something about him and where we actually have an opportunity to reflect God. In Genesis 4, we read our first introduction of sex is Adam knew Eve, and she conceived. So there's five words. We know that they had sex. And that word in English is not as accurately described in English as it is in Hebrew. And so the word in Hebrew is actually yada, and it's a knowing that is a deeper level of knowing, not just a physical knowing, but an emotional knowing, a depth of knowing and accepting that I think God really, really had a heart for when he designed sex. The conception part, actually, let me go. Hold on, I wanted to read a quote here. Philip Yancey, actually, a Christian writer, wrote this about sex, too. In one sense, we're never more godlike than in the act of sex. We make ourselves vulnerable. We risk. We give and receive in a simultaneous act. We feel delight entertaining into the other in communion. Quite literally, we make one flesh out of two different persons, experiencing for a brief time a unity like no other. Two independent beings open their inmost selves and experience not a loss, but a gain. So God really, he really had a heart of knowing of what he really wanted, a level of intimacy and connection and knowing that would be a part of a sexual experience.
It's a very mystical vision of sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. We don't necessarily think that. I think most of us wouldn't think that having sex gives us the opportunity to reflect God. I don't think that's usually in our thought process.
It's not what I'm thinking about usually.
No. But think about even with conception, we have this opportunity to have children, which is this creating. We get to kind of partner with God to create another human being. And so that's an aspect of being able to be like God, reflect God through the act of sex.
Speaking of creating other human beings, is that all that Christian sex should be about, is just creating babies?
No. God certainly had a bigger idea in mind when creating sex. In fact, we see that with like some of the hormones that are released during sex. Sex is certainly for bonding. During and after sex, the body releases something called oxytocin, which is the bonding hormone, and we're most familiar with it with women when they breastfeed. They secrete that, and it helps with the bonding between them and their child. Well, it also is something that the human body secretes during sex, and so there's this bonding, this connection that can happen on a physiological level as well as vasopressin is another thing that the body secretes during sex, from the brain actually, and it's a lot higher in men than it is in women, and that creates this experience of loyalty and protection. So there's just a lot of good things that happen as a result of sex, as well as pleasure. So I deeply believe that God created sex to be pleasurable as well. And we see that in the human body, too, in that there are a lot of nerve endings with our different parts. And specifically with women, they have a part called the clitoris that has no reproductive value whatsoever, but is just there for pleasure. And so I really believe when we look at how God designed human bodies, he really had a bigger heart than just procreation. He really wanted people to have pleasure together and to be bonded and to just really strengthen their relationship through sex.
Give yourself a high five for saying clitoris in a worship service.
Thank you.
From the stage.
Give me a fan, please. It's hot in here.
Which, that's intriguing to me from the perspective that I think the stereotype that sometimes we have of Christians, or just in general, is that women they kind of hold their nose and sort of suffer through it, and there's not really, it's not really about pleasure. The pleasure's on the man's side, but you're saying that the woman has features to her body that don't have any reproductive anything, just for the purpose of pleasure.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you, God. let's talk about some of the problems first, and then let's end on what makes good sex. But let's start in the sort of the weeds. What are some of the main problems that you see in couples that come that you counsel on this issue of sex?
Yeah, sometimes there are things physically that are not going well, arousal or difficulties with actual technical aspects of sex. But more often, I tend to see dissatisfaction difficulty kind of navigating. When do couples have sex? How does that start? You know, how do they negotiate that? That takes work to understand and navigate that, and sometimes it causes some stress. I see people where there's sometimes pain associated with sex, or just a total lack of desire to be sexual. So there's a lot of different difficulties that people can run into over time. It's another piece, our bodies change over time, and so sometimes things, you know, in the past may have been working really well, but then we find, you know, that there's a shift in hormones. Like, we know that menopause really affects women in different ways, and just really understanding and knowing that is a really important part of sexual relationship, and is having a good understanding of what you can expect.
What role do sexual problems play in infidelity?
It can be a part of infidelity, certainly. It doesn't a lack of sex doesn't cause infidelity. It can be kind of a contributing factor. I think when we don't address our sexual desire or our frustration with our spouse, or we have kind of a secret fantasy life that we, you know, anytime we choose to really be overly secret about those kinds of things, like sometimes those things can grow in our minds and in our hearts. And that paired with opportunity, if we have opportunity to be with somebody else and we are feeling dissatisfied, those two things together can create unfortunately infidelity in relationship.
What can couples do to guard against that?
I think you're going to hear me say this multiple times, but to talk about what are the boundaries in your relationship, knowing what you are attracted to, that's a really important piece. You need to know where your vulnerabilities are in terms of the potential for infidelity. You know, if you're really attracted to a certain kind of person, you probably need to steer clear of them to really honor your relationship with your spouse.
You mentioned fantasies. Let's talk a little bit about fantasies, because that's something that, first of all, we don't usually talk about that at all.
Yeah.
Even with our spouse, let alone in church.
Yeah. Yeah, we're really pushing the envelope here.
Yeah, are fantasies all unholy, unhealthy, or are there holy and healthy fantasies? And what happens when one person's fantasy is the other person's nightmare?
Yeah, so fantasy in any realm of our lives is just using our mind, using our imagination. I mean, you could have a fantasy about sort of your perfect vacation and what that would look like. Fantasy in and of itself is not a bad thing. But fantasy in terms of sexual fantasy needs to certainly be disciplined. If you start to think about somebody who other than your spouse, that is crossing a line. That is not likely pleasing to your spouse. And so couples can have and share fantasies together, but it's really important that we have healthy boundaries around that in our relationships. So the other thing is, too, is your fantasy life needs to really guard and respect the other person. So even if it's your fantasy, if you bring that into the relationship, once again, there's this kind of negotiation that needs to happen about whether or not that's okay with the other person. When one person's fantasy is hurtful or it's disturbing to the other person, that's not respectful. That's not a good atmosphere for a healthy sexual relationship. So it really needs to be something that couples work out together and that they really understand each other and that they have good boundaries.
Give us an example of a healthy or holy fantasy and maybe how they might differ in a couple.
Sure. So one person may sort of fantasize about having like a ton of time to just be with the other person, to, you know, not be hurried or rushed, to, you know, be able to do things they enjoy together. Maybe it's like go kayaking or something, maybe cooking dinner together, and they may sort of slowly move into, you know, just laying with each other naked and just exploring and that kind of thing. For one person, they may have a fantasy around really just having a lot of time and energy that they can spend being intimate, you know, kind of leading up to sex.
This is like all day foreplay.
Yeah, basically. So that's one example of a fantasy. And another may be somebody who is getting home from work and they've had a long day at work, but they get home and they walk through the door and their spouse is, you know, waiting for them, you know, naked, and they're ready to have sex, you know, right in the hallway. So those are two really very different examples of things that people may fantasize about. Neither of them are right or wrong. They're just different. It's important to understand what is it that is interesting and intriguing to your spouse.
When one has the one fantasy and the other has the other fantasy, how do they navigate those differences?
Well, I mean, that's part of the kind of the reciprocity too, as long as it's not disturbing, once again. That's the reciprocity of a healthy sexual relationship long term, is that, you know, sometimes it may be more about one person than the other person. There's give and take in a healthy sexual relationship. And as long as you can take sort of that longer view and you see that it hasn't been really unequal all the time, but that there may be times where one person, you know, gets more attention in a sexual time than the other.
It reminds me of John Gottman, who's a researcher on relationships, talks about that third graders can answer most relationship problems. So if you ask a third grader that, not that it would be appropriate in this particular instance, but what should a couple do? The third grader would say, well, sometimes you should have sex in the hallway and sometimes you just should have sex all day long.
Right,
like,
right.
I mean, it's just like, you know, you give and take there.
Both.
A little bit.
Both,
right, yeah,
right.
Yeah. There are some real challenges that people experience in the bedroom, and I think they're related to histories. We did a survey over the last 2 months or so of people's relation or experience with sex and relationships, and we found that only a third of those who took our survey, so we had about 240 people who took the survey, about a third of them were from Sycamore Creek, a third were from other churches, and a third were not in any kind of church. Only a third of those who took the survey have never experienced sexual harassment or abuse of any kind. 42% of women and 22% of men have experienced sexual abuse, and 30% of women have experienced domestic abuse, and 20% of men. So, I mean, almost one out of every two women has experienced some sort of form of sexual abuse, one out of every five men. I mean, this is staggering to me to think about that. And I can't imagine that doesn't impact the bedroom of a married couple. How do you help couples navigate those challenging histories?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is part of the reason why it's so important to be really open and honest with each other. I think you know, anything that God created to be good and wonderful has the potential of being distorted. And so being able to be open and honest about what you may be affected by in your sexual relationship, if there's something that's happening that is triggering some kind of abuse that really needs to be dealt with, it can create some just really long-term problems if not dealt with. And usually working with a professional can be helpful to navigate that. I think it's important to understand, because the way abuse affects a person is very individual. And so I can't give you a sort of one, you know, kind of answer, but just really understanding personally for that person how they're affected by that. You know, does that mean they have no desire? How does that mean there are certain things that really are frightening to them? We know that abuse it sets off the stress response in a person, and that's something that greatly impacts healthy sexual relationships. Is if a person is feeling really stressed out, they're just not likely going to have a good experience. And so just understanding the impact of that abuse, and if you're a partner of somebody who's been abused, you really need to learn about that and understand that more deeply as well. Because it really has a deep effect on people. And if you haven't been abused, you don't experientially know that. So it really, being educated, learning about it, learning how you can be supportive, learning what is off limits for that person, and not demanding too. When somebody has been demanded for something, demanding again really just is very harmful to that person. So
in the example you used earlier of fantasies, if your spouse has experienced some kind of abuse in the past, probably showing up and you're naked in the hallway is,
it could be terrifying,
almost a trigger
sure,
for that, and that's going to be, you might want to send them a text ahead of time to
Yeah, you want to agree whether or not that's an okay expression of your sexual relationship.
We also found that only 8% of the people who took our survey have not viewed or seen porn in some way or another. So, I mean, 92% of people have seen porn. 25% have viewed porn in sixth grade or younger. So I first saw porn when I was in second grade. My oldest son is going into second grade. I'm intending to talk to him this summer about that. I don't imagine, I mean, that proliferation of having seen porn has got to have also impacts on body images in couples and in what expectations come into the sex life of a married couple. Tell us, help us understand that a little better and how we can work in the midst of that to have healthy sex lives.
Yeah, so one of the things that pornography does is it gives us images of people that are other than our spouse. And actually, sexual relationship has a lot to do with our mind and disciplining our mind and what we're thinking about and what we're looking at. And in fact, some writers say that 80% of good sex has to do with your brain, has to do with your mind as opposed to your body. And so pornography can really wreak some havoc in that regard with just having images of things and not focusing on your spouse. And it also really sets up a very inaccurate view of what sex looks like. It sets up this idea that people are just ready to have sex and that it doesn't take any kind of work to make that happen, you know, like they just wake up and they have sex. And most women and men that I talk to are like, no, you need to brush your teeth first. I mean, people are not getting up and brushing their teeth or like, you know.
That never happens in the movies.
No, it just
doesn't.
I mean,
not even in just porn, but like in regular romantic scenes.
Exactly. Everything looks like it just works really well, you know. And so it does give us an inaccurate picture of what sex is supposed to be, and it also detracts us from our spouse. And so I think pornography is problematic in that we need to really train our brain to be thinking about our spouse. And actually another thing that that I had been reading about the mental strengths of is that we store images too, and we can store images of our spouse too, which is a really healthy part of using our brain to help with sex. And so our brain, we just need to discipline it.
Talk about body image in the midst of that. I think women get the brunt of this, of the expectations around body image. How do men, or how does the spouse who's trying to help the other with body image issues, how do they do that well?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this in the first service. You know, in Scripture it says that, you know, Adam and Eve were naked and unashamed. And that is something that just doesn't happen very often anymore. I think there's this piece of when we can really accept our spouse's body, when we can really speak about the things that we really do love and cherish about them physically, that we're not comparing them to some sort of ideal that's unattainable. We can be somebody who helps to repair some difficult body image that somebody may be dealing with. But it certainly is a factor, because our body is the tool in which we are sexual with. And if we have a difficult relationship with our body, it can interfere with sex. And so I think it's important to be verbally to say, you know, what you like and appreciate, you know, outside of the bedroom, be willing to say and notice your spouse's body in healthy ways.
Let's end on a high note here. What makes for good sex?
Yeah, I talked a little bit about the non-demanding aspect of it. When we get into a relationship where one person is demanding, which does happen, or they're just putting pressure, it can create a lot of stress. So don't demand sex from your spouse. And I know that this is a hard thing, because couples have different levels of desire and in terms of how frequently they wish to be intimate. So don't demand another piece is to the mutuality of sex, like that both people should participate in both giving and receiving. And like I said, it's not necessarily every single time, but over the long haul of your sexual relationship, is there both giving and receiving that's happening? Are both people experiencing some kind of pleasure from that interaction? So is it mutual? Another piece is it flexible? And I don't mean acrobatic or anything weird like that. But I mean, in understanding that, I think God's desire for our sexual relationships long term requires us to understand that things are going to look different at different points in time in your relationship. There may be times where sex is frequent. There may be times where there's so much external stress that it's just not happening very often. There may be times where physical illness makes certain things impossible. Their menopause hits or aging process hits for both men and women, and things are going to look a little different. And so it's really important that both people have this mentality and understanding of flexibility and being willing to kind of readjust some of their expectations, being willing to have conversations about what is different and what can we do about that. That's a lot of what I end up doing with couples is helping them negotiate and to be able to really talk about, this doesn't work the same way it used to, or, oh man, we have kids, like, when are we ever going to have sex? So being flexible in your sexual relationship is a part of good sex.
Our survey showed that there were couples who were having sex 3 or more times a week who were unhappy, and couples who were never having sex who were happy. That surprised me. Did that surprise you?
No. You know, frequency doesn't mean satisfaction necessarily. And so, and most people want to know, like, what's okay frequency-wise? It's like probably one of the biggest questions I get. And there is not really, there's not a norm for that. It really depends on both people. And so sometimes people can be having sex often, but the quality of it isn't very good. And sometimes people may be having sex less often, but the quality is really good and they are really satisfied. So there are different things besides frequency that impact satisfaction.
Sprinkled throughout our conversation, you've hit on some of tips for improving our sex life, but summarize that for us. What are your top tips for improving our sexual relationship with our spouse?
Yeah, being able to talk directly about it is a really important piece. And setting aside time outside of when you're being intimate to talk about it can be helpful. It sort of takes the pressure off from it in the moment. I talk to a lot of couples about how do you negotiate? How do you navigate this initiation? And how do you, and they just look at me like, well, that face, when he makes that face, I know he's interested in having sex. So it's one of the things that couples do so indirectly, and we rely so much on such random variables to decipher. So talking directly about it and being more willing to be upfront and about it.
When do couples, I mean, I'm thinking about like the couple who says, well, are we going to go like out to lunch this afternoon and talk about this over, you know, in a restaurant, or you're going to go have coffee at the local coffee shop and have this when do these conversations happen?
Well, being intentional about finding time. Like, some couples may feel comfortable talking about it in a restaurant, and other couples don't even feel comfortable talking about it totally in a private space. So you really need to know, you know, what's going to work for you, what's going to set up this conversation to be a worthwhile one. So being intentional about when to talk about it.
Yeah,
setting aside that time.
You might have to talk about when you're going to talk about it.
Yeah, I know, right?
Talk about when you're going to talk about it.
Talk about it and talk about it and then talk about it. Until you can talk about it in front of a lot of people.
Yeah. So so talking about it is a key tip.
Yeah.
What are some of your other tips?
Yeah. Don't forget that sex happens also in a context. I talked about this at the beginning, that intimacy in your relationship requires things like respect and honesty, being vulnerable with the other person, mutuality, looking at your relationship and saying, what is the atmosphere in our relationship like? Is it conducive for having a healthy sexual relationship? You know, one of the things that kills desire for a lot of people is when they see their spouse being really angry a lot of the time. And it's so interesting when, I mean, a lot of people, that's just a very new kind of idea, but your emotional context in your relationship really matters and makes a difference about whether or not sex is going to happen. So kind of creating that kind of safety, that kind of respect. Another tip would be, too, is understanding that sex varies greatly in terms of people and what they find interesting or what kinds of things get them in the mood. And there's not a right answer about that, you know? Like, it's okay that people are really different in regards to that. The task that you have, you know, if you're married, is to understand what that is for your spouse, what really helps them be interested, and not thinking that it's just weird, you know, or strange, or why can't you be more like me sexually? I think that's part of the mystery of sex, is that we have to work at it. We have to understand that we're different, and that's okay. And actually, I think God designed it that way. I think it creates the potential that sex is more interesting over time when we have to do that kind of work. So being willing to work at it, being willing to talk directly about it, and then thinking about that context of your relationship. Are you filling each other's love bank, I think is the...
Let's talk about that, because when people came in, there were these little cards on their seats, which I think is... This is a sex card, but it's not what
it
says.
It's not a sex card.
Because I love you. It's filling up that love tank, yep, or that love bank. Tell us what this is about.
Yeah, it's just a card that, you know, when you're thinking about your spouse when you're not with them, that's very kind. It's very helpful. It kind of fills that love bank for the other person. But they don't always know that you were thinking about them. They don't always know that you maybe did that mundane task because you thought, man, I don't want my wife to have to do that when she gets home later. I'm going to do that for her. So when you do something because you're thinking about your spouse, put that little card near it. It doesn't have to be an expensive gift. It can be just even a task at home that you did. And putting the card there shows, hey, I did this because I'm thinking about you. It makes it very clear to the other person, wow, you did do that because you were thinking about me. You don't have to guess about it. You know that they were being very intentional about the relationship. So just something that really can feed that atmosphere, that good atmosphere, healthy atmosphere in relationship.
In conjunction with this series, you've been doing workshops, one for women, that was several weeks ago, and then there's one tonight for the men here, yep, at this campus from 7 to 9. Give us a little bit of a taste of what's going to happen tonight for men who show up.
Yeah, you know, women are actually very mysterious sexually, and so I'm going to really going to tell men a bit more about women's sexuality so they can understand a bit more about that and understand what may be causing some barriers in their sexual relationship. So just kind of being practical about, you know, what may be useful and helpful to better understand what a good sex life really looks like.
That's the last thing I'm doing before I go on sabbatical, by the way, is your workshop.
It better be good.
Getting ready to love my wife sexually for the next 3.5 months. Turn over your connection card and you'll see a box on the back that says you're interested in attending that workshop. So I expect all the men to be checking that box right now. Friends, Rebecca, thank you so much for being willing to do this. I know... thank you for responding to that call in the Bible study so many years ago and helping couples navigate this from a Christian perspective and a Christian values. And friends, will you join me in thanking Rebecca for being here today? through this series, we've spent 5 weeks on relationships and sex, and we want to take some time to pray through each of those topics that we've been looking at each week. We started out 5 weeks ago with marriage, and so Jeremy's gonna sort of play a little bit of background music for us, because you have to have background music when you're thinking about sex, right? Sorry about that. I don't know why that came out of my mouth. Well, maybe the Bible does relate or equate a loving or an intimate relationship between a husband and a wife with that relationship with God as well. So take some time here, we start out in week one looking at marriage, take some time to pray for your marriage or for the marriages around you. I'm just going to do that silently now. And then in the second week, we spent some time looking at dating, building healthy boundaries by naming limits. Pray for the single folks that you know, or for your own dating relationship, for those healthy boundaries, naming those limits. Right in the middle of this series, we looked at talking to our kids about sex, and we learned that it's not just a one-time talk, it's a conversation over a lifetime. Pray for your own conversation with your children, or appropriate conversations with your grandchildren, or for those parents and families around you. Last week, we looked at a difficult issue of gender and sexual orientation, and we learned that faithful Christians disagree, but they disagree compassionately. Would you pray for those who are wrestling with their sexual identity or sexual orientation, and for our own compassionate embrace of those around us? Today we ended the series looking at what exactly is good sex. Pray for your own marriage for good sex. Pray for the marriages around you for good sex.
For Pastor Tom and his family as they go on sabbatical. And so what we're going to do is we're going to invite Tom to come down into the center of the aisle. And if you'd be willing to place your hand on Tom's shoulder or the person that you can reach, we're going to pray for Tom and his sabbatical. And we're also going to pray for Sarah. We're first going to pray for Sarah. You guys know Tom's wife, Sarah, just in the last 7 days has had two operations or surgeries at Sparrow Hospital for her breast cancer, and we're praying for a clean and clear biopsy to come back this next week, but we're also praying for comfort as Sarah recovers from that, and then comfort for Tom as he helps his lovely wife through that. So why don't you pray with me and just ask for God's continued comfort and blessing upon Sarah. Take a moment and pray for Tom's sabbatical with me. Pray for that, for a time to recalibrate. not only for Tom, but for Sarah and the boys, but for Tom on his sabbatical as he recalibrates and focuses on what's most important to lead this church. Pray for rest. That Tom would view his rest not only as a time to get re-energized, but the rest will help him tackle the mission of our church in leading us to ignite authentic life in Christ. Then lastly, pray for relationships. That as Tom's on a sabbatical, that the people he meets and the people he interacts with will continue to sharpen his ability to lead us well here at Sycamore Creek. God, we pray that you lead, guide, and protect Tom's sabbatical, that you give him all that he needs. And all who agreed said, amen. Go ahead and grab yourself a seat.
Thank you for the ways, especially that you've shown Sarah and me support over the last couple weeks. You've been a manifestation of God's love to us, and we appreciate that.